Hello, everybody. My name is Nathan Fedrizzi. I'm a master's student at Columbia University right now, studying the population genetics of dwarf seahorses as part of my master's thesis, and I'm conducting that work at the Museum of Natural History. So I thought I'd start by just discussing briefly the paper that I sent around to everybody about the giraffes. Did everybody receive that? Okay. So just to gauge where you guys are in terms of understanding of genetics, would you say you have a decent understanding of it, or you could use a little background information when I go through it, or? Background is good? Okay, that I can do. So that paper, does anybody feel comfortable just sort of in a couple sentences just summarizing what they found? Yep. Exactly.
I think was a normal conclusion of the paper, was giraffes actually care. And also related to that, possibly also related to their genetic preferences, is some of them like have different reproductive cycles and thus are, I guess you could say, physically prevented from mating, even if they're in some geographical proximity, because they're not like capable of mating at the same time.
Exactly. So for any of those who missed it, this was a recent study of giraffes in primarily sub-Saharan Africa, but a couple populations from Western Africa also. And what they'd found was people used to assume that giraffes, because they're these large, very mobile vertebrates that can travel these huge distances, that all of the populations must be interbreeding, and therefore genetically they'd all be roughly equivalent. And so we attributed coat patterning to genetic plasticity, or phenotypic plasticity, which means just the way they present themselves, related characteristics of a group. What they found, actually, is that despite appearances, and what we currently consider as one species, which is the giraffe, is actually more like 16 distinct populations, or they predict roughly 11 species and 5 subspecies within that. And this was due to sexual selection. So they predict that this differentiation in coat pattern happened millions of years ago due to climatic variations during the Pleistocene. But the result of that was once these populations were reconnected, through sexual selection, they don't breed with each other. And so they're very choosy giraffes, and giraffes of one pelage or coat pattern will only mate with the other individuals that have the pattern that they grew up with. And this doesn't happen in captivity, likely because they're exposed to many different coat patterns as they grow up. But in the wild, this selection seems to be fairly absolute. There were only 3 individuals out of hundreds that showed any sort of mixing. And so they really are on their own genetic trajectories and evolving into their own species. And so this study that I conducted with seahorses is sort of looking for the same thing. This species of seahorse is distributed across the entire southeast of the United States. So from very northernmost Mexico, near Cancun, up the west coast of the east coast of Texas, across the Gulf Coast and down around the Florida Peninsula. And so this is a massive area for a very small species, which, unlike the giraffe, is not very mobile. And so you'd expect a lot of differentiation between populations. And so that's what I was assessing in this study. My talk usually ranges from 45 minutes to an hour, so we have a lot more time than that today. So if you feel like asking a question at any point, feel free to interrupt me. And yeah, sure.
Yeah, just this may have been the paper I missed it, but how do scientists actually get data from the giraffes in the lab? Do they tranquilize them and take a sample?
Usually, so for this example, they use darting. So they shoot the giraffes with a dart. And it's called a biopsy dart, and it sinks into the tissue and then eventually falls out, and they just pick up the dart and do the analysis off of that. The more modern techniques, especially with carnivores, where shooting them with a biopsy dart might not be the best idea, they're using fecal samples, and they can test. That's much more difficult, though, because the DNA is lower quality, whereas a biopsy dart, it's fresh tissue, pretty easy to work with. For my study, I was using fin clippings, so just very, very small pieces of tissue. And the seahorses were unharmed, which was nice. If that's the case, could I just get somebody to advance slides for me?
Sure.
Okay. So today I'm going to be talking about my study species, which is this, the dwarf seahorse, Hippocampus zostrae, from endemic to the United States and parts of northern Mexico. Where I did my research, the tools I used, my collection methods, the analytical tools I'm using to assess genetic differentiation, some ongoing work, and then the significance of this study. So seahorses, it's the genus Hippocampus. They're found circumtropically and temperate waters worldwide. So on this map, anywhere there's yellow water is where seahorses are distributed globally. They are fish, despite appearances. They have very uniquely adapted morphology, which allows them to live a highly sedentary lifestyle. And so what they're adapted for is primarily to hunt in seagrass habitats in near shore environments. And they use those tails to wrap around some piece of substrate. So usually it's macroalgae, seagrasses, or corals. And they feed primarily on small mobile crustaceans, so amphipods and isopods. They'll also eat any prey item that's moving and small enough for them to ingest. And that long snout is used to break apart prey items also. So it's a siphon action, and they siphon vigorously enough that prey items tend to just fracture into pieces, and then they bring them in. All species are currently listed as vulnerable on the IUCN Red List, which is due to the trade in seahorses for traditional Chinese medicine, which has been estimated. The traditional Chinese medicine trade as a whole is a multi-billion dollar industry annually. Seahorses are a multi-million dollar item on that list. And they're sold primarily for use in various treatments, but in most countries as an aphrodisiac. And so similar to tiger bone and rhino horn, seahorses are considered to have similar properties and are valued as such primarily in East Asia. In India, people use them to treat asthma, and so they're commonly covered in honey and grilled and then ingested to treat asthma. And any organ pair, which is curled and paired, any organ which is curled and paired, tends to be something that's associated with seahorses because they form monogamous pairings, and due to their appearance, they've taken on this association in traditional medicine. As I mentioned, they have a unique mating system, and so they're socially monogamous. There have been genetic studies that show that they actually are not truly monogamous. They cheat pretty frequently, but they are socially monogamous. And they are the only organisms, seahorses and pipefish, which are highly related, are the only organisms in which males get pregnant. And so this is truly unique to fish. The females oviposit into the male's pouch. The male fertilizes the eggs inside the pouch and then provides the nutrients and resources to the developing eggs. And then when they hatch, they're expelled from the pouch. So they give, in effect, live birth. And an interesting side note, due to that mating structure, the social roles are largely reversed than what we observe in most species. And so females are really promiscuous and aggressive, and they go from male to male, whereas males are much more reticent and much more choosy about their partners because they have to pay the consequences of reproduction by allocating resources to pregnancy. So, and as I mentioned, all species are obligate coastal dwellers, so they're all found in nearshore environments, which puts them in close contact with humans and human development. So from a conservation perspective, they're a great species to study because they're also very poorly mobile. They don't really move around very much, and so local effects on the local environment will have a large effect on local populations. And these are our three North American Atlantic species. So Hippocampus erectus is the largest species we have in North America on the Atlantic coast. It's found from Nova Scotia to Brazil. There are some out in New York Harbor right now. They're commonly caught in Long Island as well. And they're usually dark in appearance. And in the north, it's interesting, they have what's called cerri. So they're these calcareous appendages all over their body that they grow to mimic algae. So it's part of a camouflage. Then this is Hippocampus reedii, which is the southern species. So they're found from the Carolinas down into Brazil as well. They're usually much more brightly colored and slightly smaller. And then this is the species that I'm studying, which is Hippocampus zostrae, which is the dwarf seahorse found along the US Gulf Coast, also small populations in the Bahamas and Mexico. And actually, this image, I was trying to give a sense of scale, but this image was even enlarged so you could see it properly. So this is a really tiny seahorse. Adult size is roughly 1 inch, 1 to 1.5 inches. And that's including the tail, so they're really tiny.
How long did it take for them to come to
maturation? 4 months, actually, in this species. The larger seahorse species will take 1 to 2 years, but the dwarf seahorse, 4 months. So they can have up to 3 generations a year. That's usually limited by water temperature. So there is almost no brooding from October to March, but once March kicks in, they can have 2 generations a summer. Actually, it's really interesting. There are a lot of different ingestion methods. Most commonly, they are crushed into powder and then either steeped as a tea or mixed into different food mixtures. But there, it really runs the gamut. As I said, there people will grill them and eat chunks in honey. They're also preserved in wine, and then the wine is drunk. Usually, in Vietnam, it's really common to see seahorses and cobras in a bottle of wine. And then that's used as an aphrodisiac itself. I've also heard, but I've never actually physically seen this, of people ingesting seahorse through snorting, so the powder. So there really are, it runs the gamut.
In that map, do they live just near the coast, or is just?
Yes, primarily just near the coast. So they need fairly shallow water to survive, because they really do need hold fast. So with that tail, they're wrapping on to anything in the environment that's going to allow them to stay relatively sedentary and pick off their prey. So they're really adapted to live near the coasts. There are some species in the Indo-Pacific, like near Bali, that are adapted. You may have seen them on planet Earth. They're adapted to live on gorgonians, which are a type of coral in the deep sea, and they'll spend their entire lives on one sea fan. But the rest of the species that are not gorgonian associated are found in shallow water. Yep.
Who are their predators besides us?
Great question. Anything that can find them, essentially. So they're not very palatable because they have these hard bony plates over their entire bodies. But skates and rays, particularly, if they find them, come across them, will eat them pretty quickly. Much larger fish, although because they're on a nearshore environment, they're not eaten too readily. And then usually they're vulnerable just to habitat swings. So because they're in shallow water, if there's a large storm and they're displaced, oftentimes they'll either be transported into deeper water where they can't survive or washed up on the beach. Predation isn't one of their main threats because they are so highly adapted to resist, both through camouflage and through being non-palatable. So that's another reason why harvesting for the traditional Chinese medicine chariot has had such a large effect, because they really aren't adapted to have rapid regeneration. Sure, next. So seahorses, as I mentioned, give live birth. The males release the offspring, which are known as fry, from pouches, where they enter the water column. And then there are two forms of larval dispersal which take place in seahorses. And this really varies between species, and there's no clear pattern, although it has been investigated. And so the larvae, or fry, when they're released from the pouch, are either benthic or pelagic at the time of birth. So benthic larvae will immediately settle out into the surrounding seafloor, wrap their tails around a piece of macroalgae or a piece of driftwood, anything that they can find. And they'll settle out and live the rest of their lives within a several meter patch. Whereas pelagic larvae are released from the pouch, drift up, and they're attracted, they're photosensitive, so they're attracted to the light of the moon. And they hang out at the surface of the water, eating zooplankton. And they usually do that for 3 to 4 weeks until they go through metamorphosis, which means they've reached a stage of adulthood in which, or a stage of maturity in which they then settle out. And so pelagic species have a much greater dispersal potential than benthic species, because they're drifting with the currents, they're spreading out, which allows them to exchange genes much more readily. So this is my study species, Sipicampus austrae, as I mentioned. This map is actually, it's been revised, so it's not totally accurate anymore, but this is generally the distribution of the species. They produce benthic larvae, as I mentioned. So in addition to being the smallest seahorse in the Western Hemisphere, they also, and which really the Guinness Book of World Records has listed them as the slowest fish on Earth. And while I think that that remains to be debated, it does demonstrate just how slow and poorly swimming they are. And because they're producing benthic fry, they also have further limited opportunities for dispersal and exchanging genes. So this really makes them an excellent species to study long-range dispersal and gene flow. So this is my study area. As I said, the species is distributed. Historically, the species was distributed across the entire Gulf continuously, and then just on the northernmost islands of the Bahamas. Due to development, and it's anecdotally, it may be also due to oil drilling and spills, as well as eutrophication from the Gulf of Mexico. The strongest populations currently are found in southernmost Texas and in Florida, with very, very sparse populations in between. I tried to go to Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi to collect, and though people were offering me preserved specimens from the 1940s, I wasn't able to find anyone who had seen a seahorse within their lifetime. So they're probably out there, but in very, very small, isolated populations. So this was their former range, and that's their current range, the green. And so for the purpose of this study, because it didn't make much sense, from a genetic perspective, you can assume that a population that's been isolated with having 2 to 3 generations per year, even for 30 years, there'd be a very clear signal in terms of differentiation between Texas and Florida. And so there isn't a lot of value in saying these two populations are different, because the assumption is that they're different. So I decided to focus for my study on just the Florida Peninsula, which, due to current patterns, which I'll show you in a bit, has some interesting questions that can be asked about it. Yes?
To what extent do hurricanes affect the population
dispersal? Well, so hurricanes are actually really interesting singular events, which will disrupt the patterns that I'm going to go into right now. So thank you. Great segue. But hurricanes do have an effect, but I think what I'm expecting to see is that they'll come across as sort of singular signals. And so I'll see that there was some connection between these two really distantly connected groups. How did that happen? But in general, the trend is that they don't have enough of an effect, because not enough individuals are actually being transported by a hurricane. So this is from the Naval Oceanographic Office. It's the loop current in the Gulf of Mexico. And this is it changes a little bit seasonally, which is the movement that you see, but this is fairly consistent throughout the year. And so as you can see, the warm water currents come up past the Mexican coast, do a loop within the Gulf of Mexico, exit out along the southern coast of the Florida Peninsula, and up into the Atlantic. And this center area is called a gyre, and so things that go in tend not to come out. So for drifting organisms, that's not necessarily a great thing. And you can also see that while these arrows change directions somewhat, there's a fairly consistent west to east motion. And so, as you can imagine, it's going to be really difficult for a seahorse on the east coast to passively disperse by hanging onto a piece of floating material to the west coast. That's just not going to happen. So here's another view of the loop current. As you can see seasonally, due to temperature changes and therefore and also precipitation patterns, which change salinity, there's some movement in water very near shore to the coast. But in general, the trend is in effect, especially near the southern part of the peninsula, west to east out into the Atlantic. You can also see it would be fairly difficult for individuals from Texas to make their way over to the Florida Peninsula, because there are no consistent current patterns to transport them. And just one more, particularly in the terms of the Keys, which have the highest populations of dwarf seahorses, and the East Coast, which have fairly stable and large populations as well, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they would be isolated from individuals on the West Coast. And what's interesting is, in terms of my hypothesis, I assumed that if this species is very poorly mobile and getting around primarily through passive dispersal, individuals or populations from the East Coast and the Keys will be getting inputs from all these other populations on the West Coast, But that process only works in one direction. And so genetically, that signal should come through. So there have been, you can just hit the second one also. If you could just go forward one. Thank you, sir. So population genetics have been studied in seahorses once before. A researcher named Lucy Woodall studied population genetics of two European seahorse species in 2011, and she found several breaks in the populations. And so this population in Biscay Bay would be isolated from the southern Iberian population genetically. And what she found was very interesting. A lot of these breaks in the populations didn't happen where it would be expected to occur. And they were largely due to subterranean topography, which caused resulting current patterns. And so they were also passively dispersing. And these are the giant seahorse species. They're much larger and much more capable swimmers. And so I expected an even greater level of differentiation in my study. And this is a study that was done comparing four different organisms around the Florida Peninsula in terms of relatedness. And so as you can see, different organisms respond to barriers in different ways. So the seaside sparrow, despite the fact that it's a bird species, it can fly, you wouldn't assume that a peninsula would have an effect on it. Populations from the Gulf Coast are completely separated from populations on the East Coast. So they're not making it around that peninsula. Whereas the horseshoe crab, which is a large crustacean, they're fairly mobile but pretty slow, plodding animals. They were able to go around the peninsula without issue, but they experienced a break in their populations between the northern and southern populations around the coast of Georgia or South Carolina. And similarly, the American oyster has a continuous, was also able to exchange genes around the peninsula, but you see a gradient in terms of hybridization. So the ends are more differentiated, and then as you get closer to the peninsula, they become related, but in a gradient fashion. And so this shows you that different organisms really respond to barriers in different ways, and we don't necessarily understand why in all cases. So for seahorses, this is another reason why this species was a great example of understanding dispersal in these types of environments. So for my collection methods, the summer of 2011, I collected seven geographically separated populations. So this is me with a seahorse. You can see how just tiny it is. That's the head of the seahorse there. And I took a fin clipping from each individual. My populations ranged from 11 to 31 individuals. And the range of significance is between 8 and 20 individuals statistically. So I was fairly on the mark there. And then took standardized photographs to allow for morphometric analysis, which uses the shapes of the head and the fins and any physical differences in terms of analysis. And that the collections were done primarily by wading out into chest-high water with a dip net and sweeping seagrass all day. If it was a good day, I'd get 3 to 4 seahorses. A great day, I'd get 5 or 6. But it took several days at each location. It's pretty slow work. The good aspect in terms of conservation to me was that people aren't necessarily aware of what's in their environment, so they're not exploiting it as readily. So I would go into a location and say, oh, do you have seahorses here? And these fishermen who would, you know, they'd say, oh, I grew up here, I've been here all my life, and no, I've never seen a seahorse. They're not here, you're wasting your time. And I would go out and eventually, I mean, it took several hours, but eventually you could find some, and people were really amazed. But it's just that they're so small, and they're from such an isolated environment, which is seagrass beds, usually on the bayside of Florida beaches, which people tend to migrate to the beaches. They just aren't observed very readily. So these were my populations. There were 3 in the Florida Keys, 1 in Indian River on the East Coast, 2 on the West Coast, 1 in Bradenton and 1 in Sarasota, which is Tampa Bay. And then in January of last year, I went back to Pensacola, Florida, and collected 20 more individuals. This was primarily to give me what's called an outgroup, so a group that's more geographically separated than the rest to compare between. And Pensacola in January is pretty frigid, so I was not expecting to have great success, but fortunately the seahorses were still there. And interestingly enough, they were all black in color when I found them, which I thought seahorses can change color pretty readily. I thought that might be due to trying to preserve warmth or something along those lines. Snorkeling, some snorkeling, but really most of it was just chest-high water and dip netting. And then I'd, you know, sweep for about 5 minutes, pull up the net, and sort through what I found. So for my analytical methods, what I'm going to be using are mitochondrial DNA markers. So from the mitochondrial genome, I'm picking out three loci, or gene regions, that I'm going to be comparing within and between populations. And the goal is that you'll get a diagram sort of like this. And so it's separated into haplotypes, which are groups of relatedness. And so they're sort of like a family group. And so the size of the size of the circle indicates the abundance of that haplotype. And then the branch length indicates genetic distance. So in this population, there was one haplotype that was really large and fairly distinct from the core group. And eventually you can get one diagram like this, which represents your entire structure. And so you can see, say this was the west coast of Florida, that the Florida Keys are very abundant, the haplotypes from there and fairly close, but the populations from Pensacola are really small but very, very different. So that's sort of what I'm hoping to produce. I'll be using a variety of software packages, Genius, DNA, SP, Arlequin, Network, Migrate, and Structure, which all do different, have different techniques. Yep.
Why mitochondrial DNA?
Well, practicality mostly. Mitochondrial DNA is easiest to work with right now, and for the purposes of my study, microsatellite were the other option. But microsats are much more delicate to work with and expensive, and they also give you a much more high-resolution image, which is great if you're looking back several generations, but I wanted to look back possibly hundreds of generations, so mitochondrial was the best choice for this. So, as we just talked about, the different types of genetic sampling have different benefits and drawbacks. And so for looking into the recent past, microsatellites are great. mtDNA, which is mitochondrial, is also great. Whereas if you're looking into the distant past, you really need to use a combination of the two. And in terms of practicality, mitochondrial DNA is much less expensive and much more simple to work with. So this is the form that my data was in for the majority of the last 2 years. These were my different populations. I ended up excluding one population due to sampling error. I just didn't want to have two individuals, which would mess things up. So they were excluded, and then I went back and got 20 individuals from Pensacola in January. So my total is 159 seahorses. And so these were fin clippings preserved in ethanol, and then from there I did the extractions. So these are six randomly assorted seahorses for my collections. You can see, as I mentioned before, in phenotypic or physical differences, they're pretty variable. And so this is an individual from the Keys. These two are from the Keys. And they tend to be much more brightly colored and smooth externally, whereas these individuals are from the west coast of Florida, so Bradenton and Tampa Bay, and they're sort of a muddy brown color, and they're covered with cerri, or these appendages. And so what I'm very curious to see is whether these phenotypic differences mirror genetic differences, or if they really are just physically plastic and they're responding to their environment by taking on camouflage coloration and growing these cerri. So ongoing work, I'm continuing to do work in the lab at the Museum of Natural History. These are my primers, which it's a constant testing and redesign process to find the right regions of the gene that are going to work well enough to compare between all three gene regions between all eight populations. And this is sort of what the preliminary results look like. So you'll get these genetic sequences, which are GACT repeating patterns, and then the areas in red are similarities, and the areas in yellow are base pair differences picked out. And this is just a rough diagram. It was sort of one of the first images I created after getting my first sequences in. Doesn't tell you anything, really, because the sample sizes are too small at first, but it's what I'm going to be looking at. So eventually, I'll be getting all of my sequences, which at this point I have almost all of them, aligning them, so making sure I'm looking at the exact same parts of the gene for all 159 seahorses, and then looking to see where there are individual differences and variations. And those software packages that I mentioned before will clump them into groups for me, and then you can start to tease out where genetic differentiation is happening and different patterns from it. So there are a variety of analytical tools that I'm going to be using. The first is AMOVA, which is an analysis of molecular variants. So the first question is the population panmictic? Which means, if you would just, the next one. Are they all related? Is there any variation in breeding, or are they all breeding, they're dispersing genes equally, as you could expect if you were looking at a population of trout in a lake? They would all just be breeding with each other, swapping genes evenly. So if the answer is no to that question, the second inference is, okay, so they're regionally distributed. So it's seeing where those clusters are occurring. This is my hypothesized version of clusters. And so I'm expecting to see a cluster in the Florida Keys where they're getting inputs from all different populations, a cluster from Western Florida and a cluster from Eastern Florida, although my preliminary results don't support this. So I'm actually happy to see that. But. And so one of the measures that we can use is FST, which is a demographic view of genetic distance. So it asks the question, are these populations different? So if you hit the next, sorry. And one more time. So looking at two populations, one in Pensacola, one in Tampa Bay, I can do a statistical test that says, are these two populations different? And then PhiST is the next test, which is how different are they? And so those two questions are actually fairly different. But combined, they give you a pretty accurate picture as you piece them together like a puzzle between all the eight populations, what's going on. So as I said, once you do it with one population, you're using the same measures on all populations and then creating synthesizing a whole out of that. I'm also doing a Mantel test, which looks for isolation by distance. So if any populations are genetically distinct due to their geographic distance. I'm also going to be using Migrate, which is assesses directionality of gene flow. So I can say, are individuals from Tampa Bay moving to the Florida, distributing themselves to the Florida Keys at a much greater rate than they are back up the coast to Pensacola? You can. So it's looking, comparing between those two populations, are they the same? Are they exchanging genes equally? Or the next option, and one more time, are they unequally distributing genes? Is there a much greater flow from south to north than from north to south? So ongoing work, these are two gels. So I'm going to be doing sequence verification with duplicates. So any low quality sequences, I'll be repeating the same processes in the lab to get better sequences and verify that what I'm seeing genetically is actually the reality, and then concluding the software package analysis. And so these are my preliminary results that I got last week. And so this is a tree. So it's a taxonomic tree. It's showing the relatedness of all the different species. This top branch is an outgroup. It's a different seahorse species entirely, which allows you to root the tree and show different lineages. And the group from Pensacola, which was my population I, are clearly distinct. So they look like they may form their own clade, which would qualify as a subspecies at least. So that's really exciting. And as I go forward, this is going to be easier and easier to identify and explore. But it's looking like that population is a unique subspecies. So in terms of conservation, if you can notify conservation groups in Pensacola that they have their own subspecies of seahorse that they should really invest in and protect, that can go a long way in terms of people taking care of their wildlife.
Could you explain that figure in a little more detail?
Sure. Sure. So this top line is the outgroup species, which is Hippocampus erectus. So it's an unrelated species added to the tree to root it. And then as these branches move off, you're seeing where it's an organization of how each population is related to the others. So for example, here, all of these individuals, which are primarily from the Florida Keys, can be traced back to a common lineage. Whereas all of the individuals from population I in Pensacola don't share a common lineage with any of these groups. So they go all the way back to the beginning, or as far back as we can explore using genetic techniques. So this is pretty exciting. And this is only for one locus or one gene region. So as I add in the other two, this will become more and more refined. But what you can see is it basically is just a diagram of relatedness. And so a clade is any monophyletic branch from this tree. And this group is really, as far as I've seen, the only monophyletic group. The rest are all sharing a common branch.
And the black area at the top?
This?
Are those lines, or is that just black fill?
This is just an underline.
No,
this?
The black area, yeah.
These are actually, it's a really condensed, those are the individual names, and so it's a I1, I2, I3, I4. They are samples, yeah. It's just so condensed you can't see them. Sorry, if you could go back really quick. And one last thing that I thought was interesting is that you can also tell how long they've been differentiating by how early the branch length forms. So whereas this group seems to have been isolated for a very long amount of time, the groups in the Keys seem to have a pretty steady rate of genetic exchange and differentiation, and these groups are fairly well structured. So it's, as I said, it's preliminary at this point, but very exciting.
How did you determine the length of time?
Yes, it's set up over time and also genetic distance, so how different they are from each other, and then the computer program interprets that by extending the branch length.
So how do you know the time?
It's actually, you have to input generation time into it, and so it'll give you a really rough estimate. For mitochondrial tools, the most I could go back is probably 1,000 generations, something like that, which is actually only like 300 years, given the species. None of these branch lengths in terms of time were subjectively assigned. It's a formula. Anybody else? So future directions for this research, I'd like to expand to other Gulf states, possibly get those preserved specimens from Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana to incorporate those and see where they fall in the tree. I'd also like to use morphometric data, so do analysis to see if the genetic differences are representing themselves physically in the seahorses. And also, some of my populations were collected through use of ornamental collectors. So these are guys who, they're fishermen, that's their day job, and they'll take you out in a boat and help you catch your fish. But they have been selling seahorses to make money, and so for the pet trade. So it's interesting to have a dialogue with them. They're not, after talking extensively with them, they're really interested in conservation, though they're exploiting that resource. It's how they make their livelihood. Recommendations could go a long way in terms of helping them harvest from the right locations, avoid dwindling populations, et cetera.
Can you breed seahorses in the wild?
I don't. There are actually some of my, so all of my individuals that were collected and through the use of collectors and unable to return to the ocean were donated to an aquaculture program called Seahorse Source, which is located in Florida, and they are the primary source of seahorses for the aquarium trade. So most of them are becoming captive bred more and more. But I didn't breed them. It was all catch and release for this project.
I mean, if this is a large industry, would laboratory breeding allow better conservation of wild seahorses and at the same time improve the species for aquarium use and other kinds?
Sure. That's actually a really hot topic in terms of conservation. The price difference is the major limiting factor. So if you go down to any herbal shop in Chinatown, you actually have to ask around because they're prohibited by the IUCN Red List for sale within New York State. But if you ask around, almost any of those shops will haul out a bag of several thousand seahorses, and they sell them for $5 a piece. But in the captive raised industry, a live seahorse sells between $60 and $90. So typically, labs that are invested in breeding seahorses have been selling them exclusively for the aquarium trade because it just doesn't make sense to sell them for $5 a piece for the medicinal trade. In Vietnam, they're trying really hard to culture seahorses, and they've been fairly successful, but it's very difficult to scale it up to a sustainable industry. And so the amount of energy that goes into raising these seahorses is just, at this point, not economically feasible to transition into basically flooding the market for the traditional medicine trade, which would be the ultimate goal. An interesting comparison is with ginseng. So Chinese ginseng is very desirable for Chinese medicine. It used to be very, very expensive until about 20 years ago. Two guys in Wisconsin figured out a way to grow it in Wisconsin very sustainably. And so now the majority of Chinese ginseng in China is imported from the United States. And the collection, ginseng was becoming endangered in China because so many wild collectors were going out to harvest this. But now it just doesn't make sense economically. It's just cheaper to buy the imports from America. So that's sort of the model that would be ideal for this. So aquaculture, flooding the market, and reducing the importance of wild stocks to the economy. But that's probably a long ways off at this point. Mostly it's water flow and temperature regulation, primarily. The embryos are pretty self-sufficient within the pouch.
Could you do in vitro fertilization?
You could. The difficulty would be getting the sperm from the male. So he only fertilizes them once the eggs are in his pouch. But if you could get the sperm, then yeah, I think so. So in terms of just an extension to the current conservation situation. This is a eBay search I did last night. So there were 12 active listings for dwarf seahorses. There's always between 12 and 15 from what I've seen over the past year. There were 128 individuals for sale with a combined value of $763. And so all of those individuals are sitting in storage tanks awaiting sale, and when somebody buys them on eBay, they'll throw them in a bag and ship them off via FedEx. There are actually a surprising amount of tropical and saltwater fish in the mail at any given point in time. And in 2011, the Center for Biological Diversity submitted a petition to have the dwarf seahorse listed on the Endangered Species Act. That petition was declined. After reviewing the petition, I sort of agree with the situation. A lot of the information was partially inaccurate, and they also listing a species that's coastally associated across the entire Gulf of Mexico is endangered would have an enormous effect on coastal industry. You wouldn't be able to develop anything, really. So it's sort of a tricky situation. I don't see them being listed on the Endangered Species Act anytime soon, and I don't necessarily think the species needs that designation, but better conservation strategies do need to be implemented to preserve them long term. And lastly, I'd like to thank the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics at the Museum of Natural History and also the Earth Institute at Columbia, both of whom provided funding for this project. Thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
I'm actually kind of interested in how you got into this, your background. My sister is going for wildlife biology. She's coming here to college. And
sure. Well, I've always been really interested in wildlife and nature. And my first job when I was 15 was working at an aquarium store. And so I was their saltwater guy. So I would set up their reef tanks and take care of their corals and receive their fish shipments and acclimate them and all of that. And the fish shipments are coming from the South Pacific mostly. And so it's really exciting. And you cut up open these boxes and there's 100 different species of saltwater fish. It's exciting. But the seahorses consistently, you couldn't keep them alive. Anything we would try, Wild-caught seahorses just don't live in the aquarium industry. And so as I researched the species to find out how to keep them alive, and just because I was interested in them, I found that they consider the losses for the aquarium industry to be negligible compared to the traditional Chinese medicine trade, in which millions are collected each year. And so that sort of got me rolling on the conservation implications of it. And then I did my undergraduate at Hamilton College in biology, and I studied seagrasses for my thesis there. But after that, I applied for a fellowship to do an independent research project. So I was awarded the fellowship and studied the trade in traditional in seahorses for traditional Chinese medicine for a year globally, and then came to Columbia and continued my work. So it wasn't anything that I planned. I actually have thought repeatedly about extending this into a PhD, which seems like it would be easy to do as I got more samples, but I think I'd be the seahorse guy for the rest of my life. But it is an area of interest for me that I hope to continue. Yep.
What are the consequences for speciation if you bring an organism into captivity? So like even the giraffe example, if they're mating with other giraffes that it would typically mate with in the wild, or with seahorses, if you were to figure out a sustainable way to raise them, what do you see?
So what you can see, as was mentioned earlier, is something called outbreeding depression, where essentially you're reversing evolution, and so you're losing all of those benefits. So for the example of the giraffes, some of them have evolved to give birth right after the rainy season, so when there's an abundance of nutritious vegetation. So if you have a species, and species from the north have a different cycle because the rainy season hits at a different time. So if you have an individual from the north mating with an individual from the south, you're not sure exactly when that gestation and birth is going to occur because they are so highly timed. So you could have a situation in which a female is giving birth during the dry season and that calf is immediately going to die. So that's something that you're concerned about generally in bringing in differentiated groups and breeding them. Anecdotally, it's been a benefit in terms of seahorses. Genetic variation and diversity is typically associated with strength for the population. So having inputs from as many different populations as possible actually is likely to increase resilience in this case, because they don't have specifically timed reproductive cycles or anything like that. So for seahorses, I think it's a good thing. In terms of the stocks of captive populations, though, they would be very genetically different from wild populations. They would be mutts, essentially. Well, so if that's something that I actually can look at with this data, is how genetically diverse those populations are. And you can assume that with any given population, the higher level of genetic diversity, the more resilient they are in terms of change. Because in terms of disease or climatic factors, if it's a very, very diverse population, some of them are going to survive and then therefore adapt to that environment as they evolve. I'm really excited to see if populations from the East Coast are different, because given what we can expect from climate change, it seems likely that those populations are going to be expanding up the East Coast. So the Carolinas within our lifetimes may have them. Within the next 20 years, the Carolinas may have populations. New York could see populations within the next 50 years. So that would be really exciting. But very few of those individuals are going to be coming from West Coast stocks. So they're also temperately limited. They don't occur in the tropics. So as the waters get warmer and warmer, you could kind of see a branching where the populations from the West Coast are retreating up to the west side of the coast, and then populations are expanding up the East Coast with nothing in the middle. So it's going to be pretty exciting to follow over time.
Are there any seahorse diseases that are indicative of particular toxins in the water?
Seahorses are pretty lucky in that aspect. They don't really have any communicable diseases that have been widely studied or demonstrated. What they suffer from most is eutrophication. So when nutrients, this happens a lot as a result of the use of chemical fertilizers, they enter the water and cause a massive algae bloom. and all of that algae consumes all of the available oxygen in the water, so the oxygen content plummets, and you see massive die-off. So that's, if you hear about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which happens every year, that's because of chemical fertilizers washing down the Mississippi and out into the Gulf. And it just creates, if anything within that zone is completely bleached white or dead, and so that happens pretty frequently. Also, heat waves, because they occur in such shallow water, which is 1 to 4 meters of depth, they're really easily affected by temperature swings. And you can also get events, as we mentioned before, hurricanes or something like that. Any localized storm could have a massive effect on a local population. But it also could, in turn, bring individuals to a completely new area to begin a founder population. So. There, in terms of the majority of pathogens, this hasn't really been investigated much. There is concern that with aquaculture facilities, particularly in Asia, like in Vietnam, they're taking ocean water into these massive breeding ponds and then releasing the wastewater back out into the environment. And so anytime you're having a large condensed population, there is a higher risk for disease and parasitic infections, and then those parasites would be pumped out in high abundance into the environment, so that could be of concern. Chemical toxins, they...
For instance, you have Tampa Bay, I forget the name of the river, where you work at the mouth of that river. Mm-hmm. So all of those are places where one would expect to have high concentrations of chemical toxins.
Definitely. I mean, and also in addition, they're eating small copepods in which they're small benthic organisms that really eat anything that's on the bottom. And so you could see some sort of bioaccumulation of that. It really hasn't been investigated much, although they are fairly, because they occur in such stable and small localized populations, they're a good indication of water quality, because if the water quality is all over the place and generally toxic, those individuals are going to be exposed to it for their entire lives and die off. So they are a good indicator of water quality for sure. Any other questions? It's really variable between species. In fish, typically 30 generations is what where you start to see really significant change. And that's, in a species like this that can have 3 generations a year, it can happen really quickly. In longer lived species, like the giraffe, for example, that was traced back millions of years. They estimated it was like on a scale, I believe, of 1.5 to 0.3 million years. So those changes happen much slower, but giraffes are on a much different breeding schedule. With microsatellites, you can actually see change within individual generations, which is really cool. So you can see one base pair change between parents and offspring, which is amazing. But it's, if you're looking on the small scale, it's great. But if you're looking at a population scale, it gets really overwhelming. So.
It's good to know that they just grow here. But is anyone studying? I mean, you just don't hear about it, I guess.
Yeah.
If you're a fisherman or something, maybe you know that. But is anyone studying our local seahorse population in the Sound or the Hudson?
Yep. They're actually in really good shape. In terms of, in comparison to other species globally, the species that are endemic to North America in general are doing great because they aren't exported or they aren't used for export. And so they've done genetic sampling of all of the different species. So people go down to Chinatown, they ask for seahorses, if they go into the back room, get a big bag, and then they do genetic analysis on all of the different individuals. And what they've found are the species from North America generally aren't represented. I mean, if they are, it's a tiny, tiny fraction. The vast majority of them come from Asia, Indo-Pacific areas. So these populations are doing really well. And the other nice thing that they're set up well geographically in that their populations range from Nova Scotia to Brazil. And so climatic factors, there's always going to be some portion of the larger species that's situated well. So yeah, they're doing great. Really common on the north shore of Long Island. Very true. Yep.
What's the genetic advantage for them? Or like, why did they evolve to have the nine such a part?
It remains to be explored and understood.
But are there other fish as the pipe?
Pipefish, yep. And pipefish, some of them have pouches, but the majority of them, the females just glue the eggs to the underside of the male. And he carries them around with him. It's definitely advantageous in terms of parental protection. And so all of those eggs are going to survive until maturity, until they hatch. So he's sort of gotten them through that massive phase of development, whereas in most fish species, they just produce thousands and thousands of eggs and broadcast them, and then the lucky ones survive. So in seahorses, all of them make it through to the larval stage, which is huge. But in the pelagically dispersing species, they also produce thousands of fry because they're going up and floating around on the water surface, and very few of them are going to survive. In the benthically distributed species, they produce much smaller quantities of fry because they're more likely to survive, so there's a higher energy investment in them. Sure, definitely. I think one of the first questions I usually get on this talk is, so why are seahorses important? And that's really difficult to answer. Primarily, it's economic significance due to the trade in them and cultural significance, which is really, I think, the most substantial. And so people just love seahorses because they're so bizarre looking. And that's great for inspiring classroom interest and getting kids interested in science in general and marine biology. Once you figure out the kinks, they're not too hard to take care of. And with captive bred individuals, you're supporting a great industry. So I definitely think there's room for it. I know of one classroom that has seahorses in it, and the kids are obsessed. So.
And when you breed them in an aquarium, how large populations do you expect to get, say, 4 months old?
Really depends on the species. For this species, they were sold extensively in the 1950s as saltwater guppies because if they're happy and they're provided with the right conditions, they just breed really, really rapidly. So 4 individuals could turn into 30 individuals over the course of 5 months. This species is difficult. They need a constant supply of live brine shrimp. So every morning you have to hatch live brine shrimp for them, which is a pain for most people. The larger species, though, are really easy. They eat frozen foods, and so it's just thawing out some frozen shrimp and taking a turkey baster and putting it into the aquarium, and they'll eat it. Those ones, however, require the offspring need to be raised in a separate aquarium on smaller foods because they actually transition from food sources when they're developing and adult. They're definitely not as good as zebrafish in terms of studying different aspects of reproduction. It's zebrafish are sort of the classic lab mouse, easy to work with species in terms of fish. They're really more interesting from an ecological perspective, I think. So that grade level, I believe, is grade 7 primarily. And also aspects of camouflage and evolution, they're great to study. You can actually, when comparing